Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Inadmissible for a B-1, How About an INA 212-D3 Waiver? I'm Becca Miller, AILA's Education Assistant, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Beatrice Ballerini from Houston, Texas, and joining Beatrice are Jan Peterson from Washington, D.C., and Charlotte Slocum in London. And at this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Beatrice.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the podcast. While we were preparing for the podcast, my co-panelist and I decided to break up the discussion into three main sections. First, we're going to begin by arguing admissibility before conceding inadmissibility. Then we're going to discuss violations that make a B-1 visa traveler inadmissible, those which are eligible for the 212-D3 waiver and those which are not. Then we're going to go into very practical tips and processing of the presentation of the non-immigrant visa waiver at the consular post. Charlotte, did you want to begin?
Sure, thank you. So I guess I wanted to kind of introduce first, just to say kind of most B1 visas are actually kind of denied for 214B as opposed to the D3 waivers. So that's just kind of an FYI. And I think it's kind of worth looking at the Department of State stats on inadmissibility because it actually gives percentages of those that have overcome inadmissibility. So that's always worth kind of using to set clients' expectations. So I think that's good kind of way to start with clients. So I guess when I've got a situation where somebody comes to me with a possible ground of inadmissibility, the first thing I do is actually have a look and see whether there's any argument to say that there's a possibility of it being admissible, the person being admissible. So what I would look at first is if it's a crime involving moral turpitude, I would kind of look to see whether there's the requisite mens rea. Some offences outside of the US, because it's always worth, you have to kind of be looking at the kind of foreign statute. It's worth kind of looking into the intent element of that statutory offence and seeing whether there's a lesser mens rea than intent, for example, recklessness, or whether it's more of a statutory violation. For example, we've had a situation where somebody was in prison over phone bugging, and while it did take a while, it was possible to argue admissibility in that case because there wasn't the requisite mens rea, and we were ultimately successful. So I think for the sake of your client, it's worth looking at that particular element because obviously if they've got an admissibility, they're going to carry that for well, likely forever, unless somebody can kind of overturn that finding.
So, Charlotte, if you tap a telephone, you're not inadmissible. Is that what you're saying?
It doesn't have the requisite mens rea, correct, even though the person did time in prison. So it's an interesting one. You kind of automatically would think that that would be a crime involving moral turpitude, but it isn't. there's a couple of ones just to remember, again, not jumping straight away to inadmissibility, is the juvenile exceptions worth having a look at, and what we would call petty exception, which is the sentencing exception. So if there's only one crime or the maximum penalty possible doesn't exceed a year and the person isn't sentenced for imprisonment in excess of 6 months. So that's always worth looking at because quite often we've got situation, particularly in the UK, where it is a crime involving moral turpitude. On its face, somebody would be inadmissible, for example, theft. But because it's a petty exception, so it would be a misdemeanor, it is actually possible to argue that it would fall under that category and therefore the person wouldn't need a waiver. So they're the steps I would take right at the beginning, and they're kind of really important to do.
Very good. Thank you so much, Charlotte. Jan, did you want to go into what violations make a B-1 inadmissible and go into some of the unlawful presence violations and canceled visas?
Sure. Let me count the ways that make a B-1 inadmissible. In our practices, we will find often that beleaguered and human shortages cause them to try to squeeze applicants into the B1. They may be an employee of a subsidiary abroad. There are no H's, L1s take too long, and they don't know about B1 in lieu of H1 or H3. So what you really find a lot of are B1s who really spend way too much time here and do things that look way too much like work to be inadmissible, and it's something like a ticking time bomb. It's only a matter of time until they're detected, and then they get their visa canceled and sent back. They can often have a fraud finding along with that, so you'll need to regroup on that. I think we all may recall some years ago when 35 Russian engineers showed up with B1s to observe and consult at the premises of Boeing in Seattle. And the Boeing CBP heard a few of them say they were coming to do things like work. And the CBP actually called the Boeing Union, not Boeing Administration, and asked if they had any objection, and they were allegedly told that these guys come and work next to them, and they were all sent back. So to protect your clients, make sure they're not crossing the line into work, or that they get their visas annotated B1 in lieu of H1 if that's the case, and that they're armed with the requisite documents. Remember, your clients landing here may well have very serious jet lag and will forget what you told them. They'll forget that you gave them a letter. Anything that you want them to know, make sure it's stapled in the passport, so for communication to CBP about why they're admissible. So that often makes them inadmissible when a CBP officer thinks it just looks too much like work and they use the work word in terms of what they're coming to do here, and the officer is cranky. So that can cause a lot of problems, and we need to caution our clients not to use that category when it is not appropriate. There are many cases in which it is appropriate, and those can be all found in the FAM, coming to do business negotiations, consultation, observation, and things like that are proper. A common thing that comes up is clients who do not know that their B1 has been canceled. Please note that 1 minute or 1 nanosecond of unlawful presence will result in serious ramifications, including voidance of the visa and a requirement that all future non-immigrant visa applications be made in the home country. That's under Section 222G of the INA. So if the penalty, so you want to monitor that very carefully when you're looking at whether a client can be admitted on a B1. He may have stayed 1 or 2 days over for whatever reason, didn't notice it, didn't know, all kinds of reasons, and it doesn't matter. The visa is automatically voided. So that's not much of a problem if your client's from the UK, but, you know, it gets very expensive for an employer to send them back to Australia or India for all future visas. And that I would caution as a practice tip. Attorneys have come in to increasingly ask USCIS for non-pro-trunk treatment for reasons which we think are meritorious. It was technical reasons. We believe they're technical reasons that are no fault of the applicant. And if you apply for a non-pro-trunk extension of an H, extension of any non-immigrant status, and it's denied, then you start your unlawful presence clock ticking. Especially if you're in a status that has duration of status, the unlawful presence clock only starts when you are denied a benefit by an immigration officer or an immigration judge. So be very careful in your non-pro-tunk and look to see whether it makes more sense for them to leave and apply for a visa, perhaps in Canada or Mexico. So when the visa is canceled, whether it has the word cancel on it or not, they will need to get a new visa to return to the United States. If they try to return with a facially valid multiple entry B1 visa, and it comes up in the CBP system at the port of entry that they believe they overstayed their last period of admission, they will in fact cancel the visa and send them back home, and then you will be confronted with applying for a new visa for them in a more defensive posture than if you went in initially and said, look, it looks like I had a day or two of unlawful presence. I'm going to have this visa reissued.
Thank you, Jan. Charlotte, do you want to discuss a little bit about fraud or criminal conduct that would make the individual ineligible?
Sure. I just wanted to kind of end on the B1 violation piece, just to kind of say before I kind of move on to that is, if you're kind of looking, if there has been a misrepresentation for entry and you're subsequently looking at D3 waiver, then you just need to be really conscious that the misrep, kind of overturning a misrep is extremely difficult. I think it's kind of around about the 25% mark. So certainly if somebody has been found by CBP to be working, I wouldn't be looking for to apply for another B in that context. So just kind of an FYI. So in relation to the fraud and criminal aspect of the inadmissibility, both of them are crime involving moral turpitude, in fact. So you would need to be kind of looking at, first of all, whether there's a conviction. There's kind of a nice definition in 9 FAM 302.3 to 2, capital B, brackets 3. Worth having a look because it actually makes reference to things like plea bargaining, etc. So that's been very useful in a couple of cases of mine where I've had, particularly in Italy, actually a couple of fraud cases in Italy, where the whole kind of plea bargaining was put forward to kind of argue that there wasn't a conviction, but it specifically says that section. Effectively says that there would be a conviction in that particular incident. So that's kind of worth bearing in mind, that it's not worth kind of picking, kind of really trying to prove that there is no conviction when in fact it won't help you. That's not to say that you wouldn't be mentioning it in any legal submission, but I certainly wouldn't be focusing on that particular area. So it's kind of worth having a look at that. The other thing is, which people get very confused about, is expungement is not relevant. So in the UK, you've got such a thing as called Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, which means you don't need to disclose certain offences after a certain period of time, which is very confusing to individuals because they don't need to disclose it in an employment sense, for example. In the US, for US immigration purposes, of course, you do need to disclose that. So while it's worth putting in the legal submission, and it might help you with a misrepresentation charge of why somebody hasn't disclosed, because one important point is travel under ESTA during this time. If somebody has got a conviction for fraud or criminal conduct that they haven't disclosed, not only is the criminal the conduct itself is a potential ground of inadmissibility, but don't forget misrepresentation as a possible ground. So that may well come up in the interview. It wouldn't necessarily be something that you would absolutely address in the legal submission, because it's kind of, why raise the point unless it's the person has been found succeed. But having said that, if it's a serious criminal conviction and there hasn't been disclosure, then I would be thinking about how you go around kind of discussing that. It's kind of more if it's in relation to something called a caution in the UK, which is a lesser offence. It's not considered a conviction in UK law, but since 2008, the US government does consider it as a ground of admission. So an admission would be the same as a conviction for US immigration purposes in terms of determining whether there'd been a crime involving moral turpitude. So again, something you need to think about. While you might be able to put counter arguments together in terms of mitigating, It's definitely worth explaining this to your client. So watch things like admission, watch things like misrepresentation. Another thing that people get very confused around is around the drug-related ground of inadmissibility. That can often, or the alcohol-related ground of inadmissibility, because if you've got a DUI, that is not a crime involving moral turpitude, but it could be a health-related ground of inadmissibility. So don't forget that as another separate ground. It is not possible to get a waiver for a condition A for a drug-related ground of inadmissibility. It is possible for what they call mental or physical disorder with associated harm, which would be what you would what would fall under the alcohol grounds of inadmissibility. But it's very rare. I've been successful in kind of celebrity type situations, but most of the time, if people, for a few years now, certainly, probably I would say within the last kind of 3 years or so, most of the time in the UK, if you've had a DUI within the last year, the chances are you will be automatically found to have been given a Condition A. While that is a physician finding, it's not the embassy that will make that finding. There is definitely a trend in the UK, and I believe certain other jurisdictions like India or Mexico are the same. So it's one of those things you kind of have to discuss with your client, and don't kind of automatically jump to just focusing on any criminal grounds. Don't forget about the health.
One point I'd like to add there is that beware of juvenile conduct that can actually amount to a ground of inadmissibility for alcohol or drug-related reasons. So if you have a juvenile, say 16 or 17, who is caught with drinking alcohol, using drugs, and the case is disposed of in a juvenile court, that can still be used as a ground of inadmissibility for substance abuse violations.
Yeah,
wonderful,
and actually, one other point is sometimes we get possible alcohol-related grounds of inadmissibility in a completely different context. So, for example, with a domestic violence type case, where again you're kind of automatically thinking about the crime, the consular officer does often start asking questions around alcohol. So you could end up with two grounds of inadmissibility there.
So we have a drunk wife beater possibility.
Yeah. but that does, alcohol does kind of crop up in any kind of violent related offences. So it's always worth asking whether alcohol was involved, because the Department of State is likely to ask that question and then send the person down to see a physician. So again, it's kind of all about preparing your client about possible outcomes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. That was very great and detailed, and I think it provides our listeners to a lot of great information. Now, this is the next and last section that we have is quite important, and I think that our listeners will get a lot from this. We're going to discuss the presentation, how to present a 212D3 waiver at the consulate, and both Charlotte and Jan will be providing practical presentation tips from their experience, including is a consular officer required to accept them? How does it work? I mean, timing, can you expedite it? How does it work? How long does it take? And what is the validity of the waiver? So I'm going to let Jan go ahead and start this.
Thank you, Bea. One point before we move on to that is just a quick review of grounds of ineligibility, which are not eligible for waivers, and some which surprisingly are. Drug traffickers, eligible. Substance abuse violations, eligible. Espionage, sabotage, export law violations, no. And that comes up often in dealing with Chinese clients and export law violations. Terrorism, yes, you can have a waiver for that. Nazi and genocide, no. False claim to citizenship, yes. Student visa abusers, yes. And last but not least, practicing polygamist. You do not need a waiver if you are a practicing polygamist, as the Department of State has decided that for non-immigrant visas only, you are not inadmissible. All right, so presentation of 212D3 waivers at consular posts. Very often, attorneys will go to a great deal of work in preparing a beautiful good guy waiver package, we call them, as to all the reasons why our client merits a waiver. And then you get, after the visa interview, you get a call from the client saying, "What did I pay you for that for?" The client, the consul would not accept the wonderful package you prepared for me, said I didn't need it. So that's a client management case. Please advise your clients that it's very likely that the consul will not take your wonderful good guy package. So we need workarounds on that. First of all, what is a non-immigrant visa waiver? Most of them are under 212D3 of the Immigration Act. There is no application form or fee for a D3 waiver. So you should prepare a good guy package appropriate for the misconduct or alleged misconduct of your client. It is important to know your consular post and shop for justice. Example, you often have unlawful presence issue, criminal convictions, and DUIs and mental disorders. So you want to know how your consular post, the initial consular post in the home country, treats those. If you don't like the way they treat them, look for a consular post who may look on the matter more favorably. The question, is the consular officer required to accept a waiver request? Well, that's kind of a trick question. It's mostly no. The consular officer is instructed that they may only submit favorable recommendations to the Admissibility Review Office of CBP. Now, there's no logic there, so just remember that the waiver recommendation must be favorable, and it goes, in most cases, to the Admissibility Review Office of CBP. If the consular officer does not want to recommend a waiver, no recommendation is made. However, if the applicant or the applicant's attorney requests, the consular officer must submit the waiver request to the visa office at the Department of State in Washington for review. However, the consular officer can submit an accompanying missive on all the reason he or she thinks the waiver should not be granted. So one can rather assume the likelihood of success in going to the visa office to ask them to make a de novo review of the refusal of your consular officer to make a favorable request. It should be noted that over 90% of waiver requests, non-immigrant waiver requests made by consular officers to the ARO are granted. So that suggests that your arguments for granting the waiver are to be made directly to the consular officer. Therefore, when you have a consular officer who won't take your wonderful good guy package, how are you supposed to get a favorable recommendation? Well, one tip that I have. So I prepare an executive summary, one page, crafted in a fashion that the consular officer may feel free to cut and paste your work into the waiver recommendation box. It's interesting that nothing actually really gets sent by mail or email or the like. There is an application within their computer, within the Consolidated Consular Database called ARIS, ARIS, and that is just a button. They click a button, open a window, and there's a very small space for them to put in there why they think you merit your client merits a waiver. So make it short and to the point. And if you write it such as you would write a proposed order for a judge or a proposed finding of fact for a judge, do it the same here. So the consular officer still may not accept your beautiful work. So what I often do is I email in advance the executive summary and then followed by a longer letter brief and exhibits. Of course, the exhibits you can count on them to take are the criminal documents related to criminal transactions. So what I do is I email that to the consulate in advance and letting them know when the client's going to apply. Then that, along with presenting at the window one one-page summary that has language that they can just simply cut and paste. They only have a few inches to make the case as to why the waiver should be granted. even though the Foreign Affairs Manual states that the consular officer must scan all supporting documents into the system for transmission to ARO, they often don't. In fact, the ARO has historically complained that they can't get the consular officers to send them what they need. So make sure you get all your points in there. All waiver requests must go to the visa office, not the ARO, except in the following cases. Any case in which the Department of State previously declined to recommend a waiver, or ARO denied the waiver, or any case in which the alien's presence or activities in the United States might become a matter of public interest or of foreign relations significance. Those the consular officer may not send directly to ARO, they must send them to the visa office for review and possible transmission to the ARO. So that is how that works. So some of the other tips that are helpful is things to consider. Can the waiver be expedited? Right now they were down to 4 to 6 months. I understand as of 2 weeks ago they were inching up to 6 to 8 months. So that has to be factored in. And then you want to factor in whether or not you can make a compelling case for an expedited waiver. It is very, very important to request it at the time of the visa interview. Consular officers really don't like to go recommending an expedite after the fact. However, if there's an emergency, there's an emergency. They're also advised to request that a request for an expedite after the fact go through the visa office, which, of course, they don't like to bother headquarters if they don't need to. So they will be expedite requests are for cases with urgent humanitarian need for travel, such as medical treatment or death in the applicant's family, and cases where there is a clear and significant U.S. government interest. In practice, I find that they're a bit more flexible than that harsh language would suggest, that narrow language. And the ARO has been known to deny expedite requests. So I found that perhaps school starting, an exchange program starting, obviously urgent medical treatment, that kind of thing will often work, or conferences. However, if there's room to blame the applicant for applying, in their opinion, late, then you're not going to fare so well on that issue. The next issue is, how long can I get a waiver for? Well, those of you who have practiced a while know that it used to be a big problem. You would get a waiver granted for a year and then another year, and then if you're really good at the third try, you might get a full validity. That rule is recently changed by the State Department, and they can recommend a waiver valid for multiple applications for admission for a period of 5 years. And generally, ARO will grant a 60-month multiple entry waiver to first-time waiver recipients. So that's really new, with some exceptions, of course. And that is the maximum that ARO can grant is 60 months for multiple entries. Of course, the consular officer may never issue a visa for longer than the reciprocity schedule permits. So, for example, or a petition validity. So, if you have an H-1 valid for 3 years, your client who needs a waiver will not get a 5-year multiple entry H-1B visas. Now, there are some significant exceptions to the ARO's ability to issue a multiple application waiver. That is if the client has a physical or mental disorder, is a narcotic drug addict or trafficker. We all know how many narcotic traffickers are getting waivers these days, of course, of any length, mm-hmm. is afflicted with a communicable disease, or was convicted of a serious crime involving moral turpitude. And they do give examples in the FAM, such as arson, assault with a dangerous weapon, housebreaking, incest, rape, or involuntary manslaughter, and has not been rehabilitated and integrated into society for at least 5 years since the date of conviction. That's kind of a mouthful. You might want to look that up in the FAM. So certain crimes you cannot get multiple applications for. 5 years after they've finished their probation or parole, perhaps they can. And the last very important one is if they have engaged in prostitution or have procured or attempted to procure or import prostitutes or receive proceeds of prostitution within 10 years immediately preceding the visa application, they do not get multiple entry waivers.
Thank
you,
Jan.
At all times. Okay, sure.
No, go ahead. At all times, you can.
Oh.
Please give us
your
remaining points. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the visas can never be issued for longer than the ARO grants the waiver, and the ARO may not always agree with the generous 60 months. They feel the ARO tends to be very independent in its in its decision making, and we must all remember that the first test our client needs to pass is the Google test. Check all your clients' social media before you do a waiver application, because we can guarantee you that ARO does, and probably the consular officer too.
Great tip. Charlotte, did you want to add something toward the end on the practical tips for the presentation of the waiver?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Jan was very comprehensive there. I would just kind of add a couple of points. Since we are dealing with the Bs here rather than all visa classes, I would be a little bit careful about consular shopping in the context of Bs because of the 214B issue. Because what I have seen is that the embassy issued 214B and not even jump to the inadmissibility points, which they shouldn't do, but they have done in the past. So that's
excellent
kind of frustrating.
Point.
Yeah, because you can't really
point,
go to
Charlotte.
The visa office over it. So, yeah, that's kind of, it is actually probably one of the most frustrating things, ironically, because it's probably better to actually have a ground of inadmissibility that you can then deal with. I guess the other thing is agree with all of Jan's points in terms of brevity, not quoting too much law at them. Remember, they're not, you're not kind of primarily dealing with lawyers when you're kind of dealing at the embassy level anyway. So, having said that, when I'm kind of looking into things like arguing admissibility rather than conceding it, and I'm kind of talking about mens rea, for example, I have enlisted the help of criminal lawyers in those jurisdictions, and that's sometimes worth considering. And actually, I know this is well beyond the scope, but worth considering in an adjustment case as well. The times that I've kind of spoken to visa officers about this is they've actually said the only times our legal submissions are really kind of read and taken on board is when it's kind of a discussion around the foreign law. So that is definitely worth kind of, I do definitely think we have value add there. So it's just worth considering that particular point. And I guess that we just need to remember the context that it's not a document heavy process, unlike USCIS filing. The embassy will have far more there's far more onus on the actual interview itself and what is orally presented to the consular officer rather than any documentation. And what you shouldn't be having is an applicant kind of relying solely on that legal submission, particularly as kind of Jan's pointed out as well, that they're unlikely to read those documents. So it's really important to prepare that client so that they understand the points that are being put forward, but that they would be saying it in their own words, because if they're starting saying things like crime of moral turpitude, it looks very clearly obvious that mm-hmm. the lawyers kind of you could be kind of arguing that the lawyers kind of gone into kind of more the coaching side of preparation. So it's just you just need to be conscious of that it does need to sound genuine. And often, to be honest with you, if the client is falling more on their sword and they're being kind of accepting the fact that they've done something and it was in their past and that they're sorry, that can go a long way in kind of turning things around for them, rather than necessarily kind of being dismissive, on what's happened. So that's kind of more the I guess the one of the things I kind of focus on with clients in preparing them is that kind of, it goes to remission as well. So they're kind of the main points I would probably just close on in terms of legal submissions.
Thank you, Charlotte and Jan. I think that this information is very practical and excellent. Thank you very much for joining the podcast, and that concludes our podcast.